Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Zero to Exit. Before we get into the meat of the discussion, Nilima and I wanted to start the show with a new segment that we're calling This Week in Exits. Basically, the idea is to talk about startups in news, startups getting acquired, going IPO, public companies reaching major milestones, and things of that nature. So with that being said, Nilima, sounds like we've had a pretty big week in exits.
Yes, Ankur, very excited. You know, momentum has been building all autumn with highly recognized names, including Snowflake, Palantir, and Asana going public. But these deals were just a prologue for the surge in December. Five companies going IPO now: Wish, Affirm, C3.ai, Roblox, and the biggest of them all, Airbnb. We'll talk about them all in detail, but what struck me about these IPOs are that they are all Bay Area companies. A lot of people are saying that the best days of Bay Area are behind us with the work from home situation. Doesn't seem so. The housing bubble that doesn't seem to be busting with a lot of non-business friendly laws that California has passed lately.
You're right. A lot of people are writing off Bay Area, and it's really encouraging to see four more startups coming out of the Bay Area. Although I'd say that IPOs are a super lagging indicator, kind of the recent departure of companies like Palantir, investors like Keith Raboy, and several other people who have moved out of Bay Area, and most important of them all, Joe Rogan, our number one competitor, he's moved out of California and gone to Austin. So definitely some concerning sign. You know, having said that, as a Bay Area native, I can only hope that we continue to represent a lion's share of the IPOs in coming years.
Yeah, some interesting stat with these IPOs. The number of IPOs this year, they're close to 400, which is where we were during the dot-com bubble of 99, 2000. We had close to 400 IPOs. And then over the last two decades, the IPOs have been up and down, averaging about 200 a year. I'm just wondering if this is yet another bubble in the making.
Good point. We've seen certainly an irrational exuberance in the market over the last 9 months, with the valuation, especially of the work from home companies and SaaS and e-commerce and consumer staples going through the roofs. But I also think that some of it is due to shifting of the economy. We are really in the middle of a tech revolution, have been for the last decade. But some of the tech trends that you people like you and I who are in the industry kind of always thought were going to happen and were going to take a few years have all happened very, very quickly over the last 9 months. So that's, I think, one big reason. I also think that the rise of SPACs and direct listings have also had a huge impact on number of companies going public. Historically, or even by and large, even today, if you want to take a company to public through investment bankers and stuff, it's a really painful process. But that seems to have been streamlined. And just in general, I feel like the dot-com era where a lot of companies didn't have strong fundamentals, you can just have a website and go IPO. A lot of the companies we're seeing now actually have strong revenue growth, are on a path to profitability. So, you know, I remain bullish, but obviously time will tell. So with that being said, let's jump right into the latest tech cohort that we want to discuss today. I'll start with Airbnb, obviously the biggest of them all. You know, they're raising $3 billion at about valuation of $30 billion, obviously, which has gone down from last year. Their total addressable market, going through their S1, is about $1.5 trillion. $1.2 out of that is in short-term rentals and $300 billion in experiences. Our revenue year to date, so their fiscal and calendar are all the same. So in three quarters, they've done $2.5 billion with about a quarter to go. And if the trends were to continue, they'll be at the similar revenue as they were in 2018. So it's a big setback. The first quarter following COVID, their revenue year over year were down by 70%. Things have improved. They are now only down about 20%. So they're on up and up in a recovery mode, but obviously a far cry from a company that's going IPO and need to show 70, 80, 100% year over year revenue growth. The good news, though, is that they're turning slightly profitable. So they reduced their marketing budget earlier this year, and we can kind of start to see that their bottom line is in black now. So that's definitely good. Their moats are obviously well-known: network effect, brand, just a highly recognized brand, And if the network effect can really take them to the kind of addressable market that they think they can get, like, I think this is going to be a pretty successful company. Last interesting thing that I found was that China is a big part of their strategy. As a matter of fact, it was called out in the exec comp. So we'll see where the growth comes from, but China definitely is a big market. So in general, I remain bullish on the company. The way they were able to kind of just generally navigate this COVID crisis relative to their competitors like Marriott and Hilton Group, amazing work. But obviously time will tell. So if we can kind of turn things around as it pertains to COVID, I think the company is going to reach $1 trillion in market cap. At least that's my perspective.
Yes, I kind of agree. I don't know if you followed their layoffs news in May. One thing that why I'm a big fan is because of Brian Chesky, the way he managed the layoffs. Almost 1,500 folks got laid off, but the way that was handled by the CEO, he was very, very transparent about it. And we talk about the culture thing being so important in today's companies, right? And we can see also how they changed the business model so fast, adapted to the pandemic so fast. That's one of the reasons why we see 20% gains that the company has posted just now.
Yeah, Brian is a force of nature. I think he's the next Bezos or Zuckerberg in making.
Yeah, and one of the other things that we've seen in almost all these companies, they raised a huge chunk of rounds just when COVID hit, which is another interesting pattern because in 9 months, most of these companies have turned around and they are now IPO ready. Very unprecedented from previous downturn of economies that we have had. With that, let's talk about the next company in the cohort. That's Affirm, which is another entrant going to Wall Street. Led by PayPal co-founder Max Levchin, this company offers buy now, pay later services for a range of consumer products. So what do buy now, pay later products do? They basically help you finance when you're buying an expensive gadget. So you can pay in no interest, multi-week installment plans, or use them also for long-term financing. Such kind of companies, their end customers typically are retail chains who want to give their end customers digital-first, easy-to-use alternatives to credit cards. They're also called BNPL products. They're becoming a rage because as consumers start doing more shopping online, especially during the COVID times, but credit availability is becoming harder, right? So this kind of business model really makes a lot of sense, which also affirms by their revenue leap, 93% year-on-year jump in revenue. A very, very attractive growth curve, at least for this year. The big red flag for me, though, is that a huge chunk of their revenue is coming from a single customer, Peloton. Peloton purchases account for 28% of Affirm's total revenue during this last fiscal year.
Yeah, interesting company. Max Levchin is among the more unassuming of the PayPal mafia, certainly not as famous as Musk and Peter Thiel and Keith Rabo and others, but certainly one of the smartest guys. And obviously he's building something, then people are going to pay attention. Amazing business model. I don't know why I didn't think about it. I can only hope that they're going to go into car dealership and make kind of all the hassles of lending much simpler with their business model. Yeah, thanks for the insight.
Yeah, one last point there is that they have competitors, Afterpay and Klarna, but the other big credit card vendors are taking notice and planning to jump in this space. So they will have a lot of hefty competition coming in soon.
Got it. Yeah, fintech's the rage. So I think given the recent valuations, I think they're going to be just fine. Moving on to the third company, C3.ai. Well, I got to be honest here, I have no idea what the company did. I was in San Francisco, actually, just last month. I was just driving around, and I saw their billboard, and that obviously piqued my interest. Digging further in, I don't know how many of our listeners know this, but C3.ai's founder and CEO is Tom Siebel, the legend in Silicon Valley, the guy who started Siebel System, the founder of CRM, if you will, sold the company to Oracle in 2007 for $7 billion. Until obviously Mark Benioff came along and took all that money away with Salesforce. So obviously a superstar, you know. So what basically they're doing is at a high level, I was able to take a peek at the kind of product just based on their website collateral, but basically they're an AI platform. So if you're building something with AI, specifically if you're in the IoT or manufacturing arena, and if you want to build a lot of predictions and forecasting for whatever reason, this is the platform for you. So basically they encompass like the big data engine, the queuing service, databases, obviously your machine learning algorithms, all packaged up as a single platform. And that platform, you can host it up on any of the public clouds. And they integrate into like 500 different vendors. So once they integrate, and if you want to take the insights and forecasting models out, you can do that through Amazon SQS and, you know, a whole bunch of other services. So it seems like an interesting platform. And with a lot of these companies, I'm like, what did people do before them, right? Like, so you understand the alternative. But like, just based on the looks of it, like if I'm a data scientist, outside of using some of the cloud native service, it certainly seems very compelling to me. So they raised over $360 million. BlackRock led their last round, and TPG, one of the private equity firms, were their biggest investors. So noteworthy numbers from their S1. Revenue at $157 million, 71% year-over-year growth, so which is really good. They expect their TAM to be $271 billion by 2024. They think that their TAM right now is like $170 billion. Which makes sense. You know, it's AI, you know, you can put whatever number and people will pay up, just name drop AI. But just to put things in perspective, IT in general is $2.3 trillion industry. So out of that they claim that they're going to have a lion's share of that. Time will tell. Quick insight, like one of the, when it's a SaaS company, you look at revenue growth and DAO and MAU and all that stuff. In the AI platform, I learned one of the key metrics is number of predictions a day. So they do 1.1 billion predictions per day. And that's how they, one of the key measurements that they take. Just like a firm, a big red flag here for me was the top three customers represent 44% of the revenue. So Caterpillar, Baker Hughes, and there's another company. I think they're like an energy company. That's 44% of the revenue. So time will tell. Interesting platform, great founder, CEO. We'll see how things go for them.
Yeah, very interesting. Learn something new about the AI platforms today. That leads us last with the Roblox, the operator of an online gaming platform for kids that has seen explosive growth in the social distancing days in the pandemic. This company reported 31.1 million average daily active users in the last 9 months of 2020. 82% year-on-year increase. And I can attribute to that because my son spends probably 50% more time on Roblox since the pandemic started. And obviously, this led to 68% year-on-year leap in revenue. Which is slightly different for gaming companies. I have not seen attribution of users to paying users in gaming companies. But like every other gaming startup, Roblox is still losing money. Finally, these IPOs may not be the last ones we see in December. DoorDash just started their preparation on Friday this week. Instacart and Robinhood are preparing to get on the bandwagon as early as very early 2021.
Yeah, interesting take. I did ask my son as well what he thinks about Roblox. And he goes, yeah, I mean, I like them, but I don't use them anymore. So, you know, maybe that's an indicator of whether I should invest or not. But awesome. Good analysis. Thank you, Nilima, for that. So I guess last question for you. If you had $100 and to invest just in these four companies, what does your portfolio look like?
So I would put my 60% of my money in Roblox because I'm really contributing heavily to their revenue through my son, as I mentioned. So I hope to make some money back from them. And then Airbnb, 40%, totally believe in the vision, totally believe in the mission. Really like one of the marketplace companies I believe in. But for the rest, the jury is still out. I want to see how that space evolves before I do any investment.
Good. You are a smart investor. I'm sure Max and Tom Siebel's feelings were hurt, but I think my spread wouldn't be too different from yours.
Very cool. So let's now get into the main segment of the show. In today's show, we are going to talk about all things product, company culture, startups with Mohan Athreya. Mohan is VP Products at Rafe Systems, a startup that does enterprise-grade Kubernetes management. Mohan is an astronomy enthusiast, an avid human psychology practitioner, and a constant learner of new technologies. Unlike many B2B product managers, Mohan's path to product management has been non-traditional, perhaps because of ideal growing years spent in Chennai right next to the beach. He started his journey as a sales engineer, sold a lot of enterprise security products at RSA, and then pivoted to product management. Since then, he has launched and grown products at Okta, Neustar, and now at Rafe Systems. Hi, Mohan. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you all.
Before we get into the meat of the discussion, what are some of the latest technology trends you are following currently?
Yeah. So some of the things that have caught my attention are things like the rise of major platforms that seem to have deep, unbreachable moats. A few other things that fascinate me are the increasing consumerization of the user experience, especially for B2B products. Specifically, if I use those products at home in my personal life, I want the same quality of experience even for B2B products. The other things that we see in an obvious manner are things like organizations struggling to straddle between the legacy technology, what they currently use, and then at the same time, transition to next gen so that they can stay relevant. And that's a huge challenge for them. And to do all of this, access to skilled personnel is also challenging. And then finally, you know, what I see are like organizations that build products, especially for B2B, they seem to be on a path where there's now a disruption because there are new delivery models. Users and businesses want to consume in a different manner. And then, of course, pricing and distribution models also are changing. So all of these put together, I guess we live in interesting times.
The kind of the center of gravity for buying decisions to move away from kind of the CIOs and CISOs to more decentralized type approach?
Yeah, perhaps. I think maybe the recent issue that's been happening with because of COVID maybe is a fantastic example. We see tend to meet so many organizations where employees have driven or influenced IT decisions in a pretty significant manner. For example, we meet organizations all the time that have perhaps driven a purchase of Slack or alternate products. They've driven the purchase of other collaboration technologies that they are familiar with. And I think the bigger thing is the learning curve on many of these products is non-existent. So it's great for IT organizations and CIOs because you don't have to spend time or as much time training the users, the employee base, supporting them. It becomes very intuitive. And obviously, organizations see that and say, well, we're going to save money this way. Why not adopt it?
Got it. And, you earlier in your career, like Nilima described, you were a sales engineer. How might the role of an SE or the typical enterprise sales person change in this new world order? Are they just selling into different types of people now? Or is this going to be more product-led, retention, expansion, etc.?
Yeah, that's a good question, Ankur. I think in a time, maybe 15 years ago, 20 years ago, products were mostly closed. What I mean by closed is it was a challenge for end organizations to even get their hand on the product, have the users try anything, and even make a decision. In today's world, everything is now different. And this is kind of what I meant by the disruption because of the way users consume and the distribution models, especially with SaaS kind of products. It's so easy for organizations to do a free trial, have maybe 10, 12 people try things out without having to go through the burden of installing anything, configuring anything. And then it slowly keeps growing from there, team to team, and it just explodes in usage. Again, if you look back and look at how certain conferencing technologies have taken off in the last 6-7 months in perhaps verticals where you wouldn't even imagine, Like if you've gone for a medical exam or a doctor visit in the last 6 months, it's probably been some kind of telemedicine. Those doctors would have been asking for that for like 10 years and the answer would have been no. And everything changed. And they did all of that without substantial training and substantial change. The elasticity provided by SaaS products, you can have millions of users on the platform with no issues. I think that has fundamentally changed how you sell the product, right? It's selling maybe is maybe the wrong word. It's essentially how do you educate the customer on what can be done with the product or platform. I think a lot of people are learning by themselves and learning by watching others. And I think a sales engineer's job is evolved into more of a trusted advisor, helping them learn about new ways of delivering those experiences inside the organization.
Yeah. If you were building a SaaS product, let's say 5 years ago, it can in and of itself act as a moat versus the on-premise product. But in with cloud and cloud infrastructure and bootstrapping a SaaS product from an infrastructure standpoint is pretty easy now. So in today's world, if you're a startup building a SaaS product, what are the other areas where you should think about moat? Because the fundamentals of SaaS and cloud and hyperscale is all kind of solved now. Anybody can do it.
You're absolutely right. The barrier to entry is a lot lower. Also, this may not be obvious, it's much easier for an organization to leave and go to an alternate tech because they don't have any sunk cost. They can just decide to move. And there are many organizations that straddle multiple SaaS products at the same time. And they can decide if they want to move from one to the other. And they can do that at will if they want to. It's great for to be a customer or an end customer in that situation. But for the ISV, how do you retain them? Yeah, well, the minute SaaS companies were born, I guess about 10, 15 years ago, Salesforce perhaps was the organization that first started this new function called customer success. It was all about how do I get the customer to fully utilize what they license for and get them to the point where they are at the point of overage of the license, as in they're getting value of the license that they acquired. So when the question comes at the end of the year saying, what have you done for me lately? There's a lot that they're getting out of the platform. But that doesn't by itself cut it, right? Now you can still go from A to B fairly quickly. And for that, a lot of organizations have built interesting solutions which achieve, in a sense, some kind of a network effect. I'll just take an example to maybe elaborate. Now, if you're a Slack user, you have Slack communities. And many support organizations, at least younger companies, seem to live off that. They have private communities or private channels on their Slack channel. Effectively, it's operating like a support function for the end customers that they interact with. It's so easy to add and remove users and collaborate with others that Slack seems to have created an interesting network effect of sorts, because it knows everything about users across the entire user base of Slack. Whether you belong to org one or org two, they're able to connect the dots. That has resulted in some interesting experiences. Even though it's a B2B product, they're behaving like a B2C company and leveraging the power of that aspect. And this can only be possible because it's SaaS. So I think that's changed things dramatically. And it's gone to a mode where customers are teaching these B2B products about new use cases, and it's up to the ISV to listen to them and do something about it.
Got it. I love the outside-in perspective about how to sort of think about building a moat in a SaaS startup. And I'm assuming a lot of that is because you've had a sales engineering background and you transition over to being a product leader. How did that background help shape your views on building market-leading products?
So it was an interesting transition for me, and I didn't expect it to happen, but in hindsight, perhaps it was the right move given the journey. So as a sales engineer, I was fortunate. You know, I was at RSA at that time, and RSA, I was fortunate that the company allowed me to work with customers in about 5-6 countries. So it's very fortunate. I mean, it's a rare opportunity to be in 5-6 countries at the same time in the career. What that taught me was you have to be very succinct in articulating the value the product or the company provides to the end customer. And what I found is a lot of organizations struggle with that. Like giving the 1 minute elevator pitch, like what do you do? Most companies seem to struggle with that. And I think you learned that the hard way in the field. You also learn some very interesting aspects like what do customers actually use? Because you'll land up showing them how to use the product and how to compete against something else. So you have your senses are wired in those aspects. You know how competitive your product is. You also know what parts of the platform or the product customers use actually. And then you land up focusing on that or emphasizing on that and selling those and the value proposition in a very, very, very succinct manner. That, in a sense, what I've expected out of every product manager that has worked for me. In a sense, if you can do that, if you can't be the primary salesperson for your own product, then perhaps you're not a good product manager, right? Because you can't articulate value anymore. So in some ways, being an SE meant that you're deep technically, you get in the mind of a customer, you know exactly what parts of the product customers use in general, and then you learn what can be removed or what is not important. And that allows you to focus. And product management is a lot about focus, right? You want to focus on things that matter. When products are just a combination of interesting capabilities, and the combination of them makes them to be superior or not. And I think that's what I learned as an SE, that not everything matters in the product. You encounter products which have 50 different features, and out of them, maybe two are used by the customers. Let's focus on them, make them really good, and let's make the customer advocates for your product. That's kind of what you learn in the process. At least that's my perspective.
One related question to that. Product managers typically work with the Triokov personas. They have to work with engineering, they work on the business side, and of course, they have to work with the customers. When your background is sales engineering, how is the experience working with the engineering side? What are some of the things you really had to learn about shipping products?
So, I mean, the advantage I had was I was trained as an engineer. And my first job, to be very, very honest, I mean, I was an engineer for 8 months, right? I didn't like it because I felt like I would be happier meeting customers, actually understanding how the product would be used, et cetera. So that's when I made the transition from engineering to a sales engineer, and then eventually to product management. So to answer your question, dealing with engineering is actually a pleasure because I think the liberty you want to give them is you want to stay focused on answering the question, what are we trying to solve? And let engineering come up with the most innovative way or the most elegant way of the how. And what I've seen is many a times is very tempting to go and tell an engineering team, this is how you do it. And it's something that I would encourage every product manager to avoid if possible. And I know this is very hard for many product managers who perhaps were engineers before they made the transition, because it's a natural function, right, to get into the how very, very quickly. But I think the what is what answers pretty much every question, like what and the why. I think as a product manager, you want to stay focused on that. And if you can articulate that, any good engineering team will help you deliver something that's world-class.
You have mentioned that as part of your career, the best time that you've spent was at Okta. In fact, it was pretty transformational on your thinking. Can you talk a little bit about the culture that you saw at Okta?
Absolutely. Okta was the most interesting experience in my career, at least so far. It was also the first company that was way smaller than many of the organizations I'd worked at before. The things that stood out for me, one is, the way I would articulate it is, I truly still believe Okta is an iconic company. What makes them iconic? There are a few traits that you can observe very, very quickly when you're working there. And you can also observe those attributes when you're outside the company. What are those? You'll sense an extreme focus on transparency. And this is transparency with employees, with customers, with partners, fairly an open book. There's no need to think twice or wonder if what they're saying is something different. You don't have to think. You know, it's a very straight shooting organization. The transparency also helps achieve another interesting, it has a side effect, at least with employees. There's an insane focus on the mission of the company. And what I observed was a CEO would make sure that every week at the all hands, he would reinforce that and nurture that. I mean, this is something that you got to keep nurturing. Otherwise, it tends to rot over time. So he keeps reinforcing it. And then eventually that results in execution. There's an insane focus on execution as well. And then finally, customer's king. Customer success is like everybody's job there. Yes, there's a function called customer success, or what they call as customer first now. But really speaking, it's everybody's job at the company. All of those attributes in the end result in driving growth for the company, which is fascinating to watch, right? The company growing 100% every year is an interesting place to work at.
Speaking of transparency, can you give us maybe one or two examples of how the CEO or the leadership in general demonstrated that when you were there?
Maybe I'll take a couple of examples. One of them actually was very interesting. So employees sometimes are bold enough to ask, hey, this has actually happened literally just before the company filed to go public. And every organization in that state, it needs to desperately get to a path of profitability, at least demonstrate that for a joint successful outcome for the investors and the shareholders in the company. So one of the questions that was posed by what I would call as a bold employee was, what about a 401k match? And organizations that are further along, of course, you take that for granted, but it takes a while to get there. And really, at that point of time, what I found admirable was, instead of kind of dancing around the issue, the CEO actually put it back on the larger employee base, effectively saying, look, this is how much cash we have. This is where we need to be at. You can either choose option A or option B. And option B here was 401k match. And option A was some of the perk inside the company. You get one of these perks, you can choose whichever makes sense. But you only get one. So it's effectively treating employees as adults. And I think employees really appreciated that, right? Because in many a situation, the employees have no understanding of what the constraints are, what the real constraints are. It's easy to ask for something, but when they put it that way, and you know that is really a trade-off, now that you have a difficult decision to make, and I think everyone appreciated the CEO for doing that, and that really stuck in my head as an example, because you don't see that in most organizations. So that's one example. Perhaps the other example that was very, very interesting was things that were discussed at larger strategy meetings that perhaps were higher level in the organization. And by the time the organization was thousands of employees, right, and distributed all over the world, the CEO would make an extreme effort to make sure that both remote employees and employees that are perhaps in multiple steps removed from the core strategy would have deep visibility and exposure and the opportunity to even confront the leadership team with why a decision was made a certain way. And it was the leadership team had to answer. They had to give a good answer as to why. And that feedback loop effectively meant that employees, it was not just a top-down thing, but there was this feedback loop that was really a feedback loop, not just a one-way trickle-down thing. So that's just two examples. And finally, I mean, I think this kind of ties into the psychology thing that Nilima was talking about. When you look at a person and you can actually sense the honesty, you can read the body language, and they're not making up stuff, right? So that kind of adds up as well. So it's fortunate to see this being done in action, face to face. And at that time, that this is all, for the most part, real, right? Not just lip service. So I think that was what was transformative for me as a company. Like, this starts at the top. And it was all because the CEO wanted to build an iconic company, right? Not just build a company and sell it and move on. I'm a shareholder of the company and intend to stay that way. Wish the company all the success.
Yeah, absolutely. Great examples. Todd McKinnon indeed is a once in a generation type CEO and has done tremendous work with Okta. The second thing you talked about in terms of what struck with you about Okta was, I guess, customer focus, customer obsession, when we obviously know about customers' obsession from companies like Amazon and Zappos and what Tony Hsieh and obviously Jeff Bezos have done. Any examples and stories about how Okta did that really well?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, maybe two examples. One is many of the top tier customers, they actually had direct access to the CEO and the rest of the company knew that. So when an email comes down the chain saying, how is company X doing? I mean, you know at that point of time that the CIO of that company or the CSO of that company has perhaps reached out to Todd or someone else higher up in the chain. That basically meant that the entire organization would do everything to avoid that situation, right? So what's the best way to do that? Keeps the customer happy. Be pragmatic as well, right? Because customers can ask for everything. You can't possibly do everything. So you try and negotiate with them early on and ensure that they get to a happy spot. And what is a happy spot? Happy spot does not mean they ask for 10 things and you deliver 10 things. So I think what we figured out was happy means the customer has achieved the outcome that they embarked on. As an example, if they say that I need to be live with 4 business units, all employees in 2 months, we would do everything possible to beat it. And then not only that, we would go back with the help of our customer success team and drive this message home. Because you want the customer to think, actually, you don't want them to ask the eventual question, what have you done for me lately? We would reinforce that every month or every few weeks. And it became a practice of sorts, right? So if you go, when I was there, you'd ask me, hey, how is this customer doing? I actually had access to a system based on Salesforce where I could actually go and answer the question. The plan of record for the customer is to go from X to Y, and they are 30% along the way. Do they have obstacles or not? And if they had obstacles, we had to do everything possible to make them successful. So what that resulted in was, you know, what I alluded to before, the extreme focus, right? The focus on execution. There are only two ways out here. One is execute like a machine and say no to a lot of other useless things, right? Just focus on the things that matter to make customers successful.
So, you had a great run at Okta. Knowing what about the post-COVID boost that Okta and general other SaaS companies got, would you have still made the move to join Rafe, a startup company, and live through a lot of uncertainty like all startups do?
Yeah, so I think I'm on an interesting journey here overall from a career point of view. You think about it, the first few years, a lot of experimentation with a lot of geographies, a lot of roles, and then eventually found the sweet spot. The role of product manager is pretty interesting. You are at that interesting point where you are critical to the company in interesting ways. Your decisions can have a pretty big impact. So as I look ahead, there were a few other things that I wanted to try. One was obviously a company that was earlier in the process. And of course, Okta now is a mature company, but when I joined them, they were a lot smaller. And at that time, my thinking was, well, what would it be like to go to an organization that perhaps is pre-Series A, doesn't have much in terms of an organizational strength yet, has no product market fit yet, and was pre-revenue? What would it take to take that organization and work with those people and get it to a point that I would be proud of? So that's the journey that I really wanted to, at this juncture in my life, I really wanted to make that happen. And one of the critical attributes there is, the people you work with. It's all about chemistry. It's all about, do you trust the people you work with? And you don't want any complexity there. You don't want any drama there because you have no time for that in a startup. And that's what led me to Rafe. And I'm hopeful, as any organization, when COVID's not easy to deal with, but we seem to be doing pretty well.
There was a comment by you that organizations are struggling to straddle legacy products that they own, the current explosive technology like Okta, and then the next gen technology that you're building right now at Rafe. How do you see these three kind of models getting deployed in an enterprise? Because there's going to be a lot of friction with these technologies coming together. And then how do you foresee that evolving in the next 5 to 10 years?
It's a difficult question to answer is also a very difficult thing for customers, because what I see very frequently, let's take an example to maybe elaborate. We all hear this term called digital transformation. What does that really mean? It could mean different things for different organizations. It's just a high-level talk track. For many organizations, it might translate to like, well, I'm going to get rid of my data centers and move them all to the cloud. Well, this is a 10-year-old story in some ways, right? People started doing that 10 years ago, and they still haven't gotten there yet. Why has it been so difficult? I think it's partly because of internal friction and lack of skills and expertise. The way you do things in this next-gen world is typically very different from the way you do things in a tech stack, perhaps reminiscent of 15 years ago. So in the end, I think businesses are comprised of people and practices, and these two get in the way. What I find is, this is one of the reasons why I've chosen to work at organizations. Look at Okta, we're lucky to be mostly seen as transformative for an organization. And at Rafe, the same thing. We are the ones that are singularly focused on helping organizations make this journey to cloud native, a la Kubernetes, et cetera. Usually inside the company, what we see is we are dealing with people that are driven to transform the organization. They're very outcome focused, and there's a thirst to learn. And those are the characteristics of the people we seem to encounter. And the rest of them, if they exist in the company, they're probably supporting a mission critical system that is perhaps based on technology from 15 years ago. But at some point, I guess, for them to stay relevant in their own careers, some of them will have to transition to this next gen stuff eventually. And that's a difficult decision for people. Many people do not make that cut. Many people do not want to make that leap because it's a lot of work. You may not have the personal luxury of time or the bandwidth to do it. So as a product company, I think it's very important not to straddle all these three different worlds. I think you want to find a way to isolate yourself into doing one thing really well, because the way people expect a transformative product to be consumed is very different from how they would consume perhaps a product from 15 years ago. I think it's very important as product managers for us to know that they're different and do not repeat the same mistake.
It's a good point about staying hyper-focused and one of the big reasons why startups win. But why do you think it is so hard to do that? When you're in early stages, you may get 10 enterprise customers asking you for three completely different things. How do you say no?
Saying no is the most important attribute here, at least in my opinion. You usually have a small engineering team. At startups, you don't have the luxury of hundreds of engineers. The bigger problem is that of execution, right? Because you have to survive as an organization. You have to be successful. And for you to be successful, you want to pick certain things where you start seeing patterns. Like, is this a problem that is uniquely interesting for one organization, perhaps that is a Fortune 100 company? Or is this something that will be applicable for a broad swath of organizations? Because I can build it once and ideally sell it everywhere. It can be used by many, many people. And perhaps more importantly, you want to solve a problem that is real and applicable to many, many people. So you want to make sure that all of these are true. And then finally, does it play to your strength? Anyone can build anything, but what you're choosing to build, does that actually make your company stronger? Does that make your product stronger, better, more interesting for other people? I think once you answer that question, the choice is clear. It's very difficult to say no, because if someone's dangling a $1 million deal in front of you, it's very hard to say no. So that's the reason why I talked about the chemistry is very important, because we always have hard conversations. It's always about, hey, we're going to do this and not do this. And if it's not easy for a team to bring that out and discuss that in the open and then decide, we may still disagree. But in the end, you still have to agree to disagree on a few things and keep moving forward. I think that requires a very good chemistry with the leadership team. And that is possible at certain startups, and at other places it's not.
Switching gears, you have published a book at a pretty early age, I believe when you were 25. I'm sure many of our listeners have similar aspirations of becoming an author. What were some of your learnings through the process?
Yeah. So I was, again, lucky. This was a time when there were no platforms available for people to blog, content distribution, and there was no YouTube at the time. The way people got the thirst for knowledge, there was only one way to get things out at that time. Effectively, it was books or you go to conferences. And I was lucky at RSA, and I used to work closely with the RSA Labs team. And I mean, I was a cryptography and an encryption nerd at that time. So I decided, hey, what would be a good way to get all this learning out in a form that perhaps others could leverage? So McGraw-Hill at the time gave me an opportunity to do this and launch this at one of the RSA conferences. I think this was 2002, I think. Feels like ages ago. So did that. Now, I was naive as well at that time in the sense, I was 25, I had no idea what kind of effort this would take. I think I must have spent 4 or 5 months every weekend writing. And at the end of it, once it got done, I decided I'm not going to do this again for a while. It's a lot of effort, especially when you hold yourself to a high bar, because you want your output to be pretty good. And it can be a lot of work if you prepare to do it. There are other avenues now. I encourage a lot of other product people, at least in my teams, etc., to leverage things like YouTube to get the word out, Twitter to get the word out. It's a good channel to get blogs out. And there's so many new avenues now, unlike those days.
Very inspirational. And as somebody who's been wanting to write a lot, but has not been very successful, I've got to pick your brain maybe offline on how do you end up writing hundreds and hundreds of pages of coherent material, but that's probably for some other day. You've led small and large teams in your career. What are some of your guiding principles for creating a highly functioning team?
So it comes down to, I think, two things, right? You think of your team as a combination, and in the end, the team is people. And so hiring becomes a very important attribute. How do you hire? How do you retain people? What kind of people do you want? Because you don't want nonstop friction in the team. Product managers, in some ways, are problem solvers. So you kind of want to look for those attributes. But they should not be simple problem solvers that are trying to deflect a problem or make it go away. They should hold themselves accountable to a high bar, as in they should be proud of the work that they delivered. So you want to assemble a team where there are like-minded people as much as possible. But at the same time, you want a team where they can build on each other's strengths. So hiring for me has been a very important and a critical decision. And I look at the team structure and I constantly look for gaps in the team's structure and surgically hire to fill those gaps, because not everyone expands to fill all the areas. Some people are people. They like doing what they're doing. Inherently, that's what happens. So as a manager, you look for those gaps that you need to address in the organization and hire for that, or even justify to hire for that. The other thing that I like to do is shake things up a little bit, because one of the things that happens in most teams is you settle into a pattern. And when you get comfortable, bad things can happen. Competitors are not sitting around. The market's not sitting around. So one of the things I've done very frequently is kind of change the status quo a little bit inside by making a hire. Sometimes it's an intern, sometimes it's an employee, perhaps from a completely different kind of a background, who brings a fresh kind of a thinking in an organization. And we found that has been, in many cases, transformative for the team culture, because now they know that, hey, there's another way. It is not this way. And it opens their minds if they are willing to be open. These are some of the examples. And finally, all of this comes down to, I think, been forced to read people's minds to the extent I can. I think I've forced myself to do that. And I think I'm wired in a way to also do that because of my pre-sales background. You tend to look at how the team's behaving. Is there chemistry? What's the dynamic in the team? and then proactively address problems if things are emerging, especially signs of friction, and address them early on and pull the Band-Aid out so that the problem doesn't fester.
Has your perspective on centralized teams versus finding the best talent across the globe changed post-COVID?
It's been very difficult. I think we are in uncharted territory, to be very honest. Many organizations I work with, including where I work at, nearly 30% to 40% of the employees have actually never been to an office, have never met their manager. There's no sense of corporate headquarters per se. They are all highly effective personnel. My bigger fear at this point of time is how do you establish team chemistry when everything is virtual? Yeah, how do you ensure people don't show up for a meeting for the sake of the meeting? Because one side effect of COVID has been there's been a lot more meetings, unfortunately. Miss these conversations in an office, whiteboarding. How do you replace those with an alternate model? I don't know the technology for that exists. In fact, a few weeks ago, I had to talk to one of my colleagues at another company. He's a CMO at Arctic Wolf. He was struggling with that. I mean, he's himself virtual, and he was asking, Mohan, is there any tool that you're familiar with which can act as a virtual whiteboard of sorts? Because I remember him, he and I used to whiteboard day in and day out. And when you're wired that way, how do you replace it with a team that's all over? It's very hard. So I guess the jury is out on that. We'll see what happens.
It's a well-proven fact that if you have diverse teams, they have people who are change agents. And having diverse team thinking sometimes really, really helps. These people can be connectors in this kind of environment. I've seen that work very well for my team. And women team members kind of really help collaborate and drive that piece. So that's very helpful. What is your advice to turn mentors into sponsors for our women listeners on the call?
Yeah. In fact, one of the best hires, I think, in my whole career that I made was actually a woman I hired at Okta. Well, she was the only woman on the team in the end, which is mostly men. So it was an interesting addition, right? But I think she made a substantial impact in the organization. She would run circles around everyone else. The thing that I noticed was she was not able to ask for certain things. If she felt she had to prove herself to be maybe 50% better than some of the other guys in the team before she could ask for certain things. And I had to break that, right? Like literally had to give her certain opportunities and push her to get out of the comfort zone. For example, one of the things I did was I lobbied to get her to co-present with the CEO at Okta's annual, it's called Octane. It's a large event for the company with customers, etc. I know she was extremely uncomfortable, but she got over it and she's done extremely well. As a manager, I think, look for these little signals that you find certain people who are diamonds in the rough. And then, I mean, I would say this is something that every manager needs to keep an eye out for. Look for these people, look for the diamond in the rough, keep challenging them, give them more and more. Do not hold back, give them more and more. And as they continue to do more, help them get out of the comfort zone, right? Like help them do things that they didn't realize was possible. And that helps them grow into interesting change agents in a company. And also the culture of the company, this is another thing I mentioned. And I talked about Okta as an iconic company. The advantage I think she also had was there were a lot of other women in other roles who were in very senior positions. So the company had a culture of encouraging that as well. And so that also helped. It might have been harder at a company where perhaps it was maybe monopolized by men. So yeah, this is something that I think speaks to the culture of the company. You have to find a way to find the best people in an organization and nudge them and push them to do better. At my level as a manager, I don't really differentiate. I try and push for the best. And in this case, when you find a woman who is a diamond in the rough, push for her, lobby to get her to be successful, give her the opportunities, and let her shine.
Thank you for that, Mohan. That was super insightful. I certainly can only hope that more technology leaders pay more attention to getting more diversity because it can only help us build a better product. If half of our consumers are going to be women, we might as well have some of that perspective in building great products. So that certainly brings us to our last and the final and my favorite round, and that's rapid fire. I'm going to ask you a few questions and get your response. You ready for that?
Let's do it.
All right. If you had $100 to buy stocks, what does your portfolio look like today?
Yeah, I would bet on organizations that are transforming businesses and disrupting businesses. So I would pick those.
Do you have a specific stock recommendation? And I should mention to our listeners that we are not a financial advisory services. Our guests' opinion are their own. But any specific companies, obviously, who are publicly traded, that piques your interest and would represent your portfolio. If you had $100.
Yeah, I've invested a bunch of money in Tesla. It seems to have done well. I've invested a bunch. I actually have been an avid Bitcoin investor as well. The last 8 months, I thought I made a horrible mistake, but it's turned around.
Awesome. What are you reading or listening to nowadays?
In terms of music?
Books or pod,
yeah.
And feel free to share music taste as well.
Yeah. So yeah, so music, I think I'm stuck in time from a long back. I'm a huge Queen fan and I've been stuck with that for, I think, 15 years, unable to break out. In terms of reading and books, I think I'm an avid podcast listener and I still go for walks and listen to podcasts. And there's a bunch that are really, really interesting. Like there's one that I listen to almost every week if possible. It's actually a BBC podcast called In Our Time. And they talk about history for the most part. And it's about people maybe from 50 years ago, 100 years ago, or maybe even before that. And it's a bunch of professors who kind of summarize the life of that person and their journey. And it's very insightful as to what they did, how they did. And this is an example. What do you know about Galileo, right? Like we have a bookish knowledge of Galileo. What if we can literally watch his life, or at least someone describe their life, their birth, what made them Galileo? That perspective has been mind-blowing for me. So I listen to that all the time. I'd highly recommend it.
Yeah, I've got to check it out as well. I'm a huge podcast fan myself. Who's been your biggest inspiration in the tech industry?
I mean, I'm probably going to sound like a broken record. I'm a huge Apple fan. So Steve Jobs was. I don't think anyone else has replaced that position yet. And yeah, it's the person who says a million no's and knows the end customer and makes a huge calculated bet. I mean, like, how could someone do that and pull it off 3 times, 4 times, not just once? So and as Nilima knows, I'm a huge Steve Jobs fan.
Absolutely. Who should we invite next on the pod?
I would recommend a couple of people. If you folks are interested, I would introduce you to Eric Berg. He was a CPO of when I was there. He's the one who hired me. He's an interesting person to talk to. The other person is Dan Larson. He's a CMO at Arctic Wolf in the security space. They are doing some very interesting things. And as a marketer, might be an interesting person to talk to.
Got it. We have added them to the list. What advice you'd give to your 18-year-old self?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest advice is take chances. I think when I was much younger, perhaps because of the circumstances in which I grew up, I was very, very calculated in taking risks. And I think what I learned over time is I should have taken a lot more chances. It would have probably worked out. And even if it didn't, it wouldn't have mattered. I think that perhaps I just didn't have the guts at that time to take those chances, perhaps because of financial circumstances, etc. And that's what I would recommend to everyone. Take chances.
Yeah. It's also got something to do with being in 40s. We so far have had 100% of the guests in their 40s and above say the same advice like you did. All right. Second last question. Do humans become interplanetary species in our lifetime?
I don't think it'll be in our lifetime. And what I mean by that is, yes, I think humans will land on other planets. I think it's bound to happen in the next 10 years or 15 years when we have someone who is Elon Musk is extremely motivated to make that happen. So it will happen. And what I mean by interplanetary is a permanent base of sorts. I think that's going to be difficult. It's going to take a big push by not just individuals, but maybe by countries before that is possible. But I certainly wish that happens. I mean, if it happens, great. But I'm not holding out hope for that.
Got it. And last question, where can people learn more about your recent work?
My recent work, mostly at Raffae Systems. So I would suggest people go look at raffae.co, R-A-F-A-Y.co. And I also blog as frequently as I can. And I have a bunch of videos on YouTube. So these are where I'm spending my time these days. This is one of the reasons why I stopped writing books these days, because there's so many alternatives. So check them out. And yeah, I also can be reached on LinkedIn. If I do get on a bunch of calls with people that are earlier in the career and assist them where possible. So anyone who is in that kind of league, absolutely reach out, and I'm happy to help.
Got it. Yeah, we'll be sure to put that up on our show notes. And that concludes our podcast. Mohan, it's been a pleasure talking to you. For lifelong learners like Nilima and I, we can do this all day long, but we want to be mindful of your time, which you have been extremely generous with. So thank you so much.
Thank you again, and appreciate the opportunity.